Good morning, diners and travelers. Thank you for listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Today, I think we're mainly doing cookbook adventures, are we not, Peter?
We are, but they're cookbooks each with a story. They're unconventional cookbooks,
yes,
to say the least. If unconventional is a word, then how do you say unconventional cubed?
Yes,
how would affect your four?
Because
our first story is about a restaurant, but it's also a lifestyle. About Joe Beef, the brainchild of some young men in Montreal, Canada, who created something way more than just a restaurant. And when you listen, you'll know what we mean.
Now, we're going to conduct this interview very gently. And there's a reason why. Because our guest at this moment, Frederick Morin from Joe Beef, has a hangover. and he ate the wrong thing from his book to cure it last night. And we were discussing the fact that he should really have had the bacon fried kale with a fried egg on top, but instead you opted for something different.
Yes, unfortunately, and it doesn't work as well.
Which one was that?
Chickpeas.
So if you get this book, the guaranteed hangover cure is kale with bacon and a fried egg. Skip the chickpeas.
And a nap, yeah, the nap is...
But this is really...
You know what, you're right, I should have written the nap as an ingredient of that dish.
Well, the kale dish with the fried egg, it says then go to bed.
So you
have to do it before you actually go to bed.
Well, how are we ever going to explain this?
Well, wait a minute, we'll get there, because...
This is not just a cookbook.
This is a lifestyle.
It is. It's called The Art of Living According to Joe Beef. And the spokesperson for this establishment and the book is Frederick Morin, and he is in Montreal. Welcome to On the Menu, Fred.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
So where did Joe Beef come from?
Well, Joe Beef, our restaurant, Joe Beef, has been open for, what, close to 7 years now.
Now, David Chang did the introduction, and he said it was his most favorite restaurant in the whole world. That has to have been giving you a little bit of a push here, huh?
Yes, absolutely, and I'll come to it later. I think where the true reasons he said that.
Okay.
But just the Joe Beef, right? It opened 7 years ago. But when we were opening the restaurant at that time in Montreal, everybody, or in Montreal or in North America, everybody was serving food on large square plates. It was a pretentious vibe in restaurants. It was a playlist that came from, like, the Cost Hotel in France. It was very minimalist, and it had names like Bleu with the umlaut, you know, and people, and it wasn't us. So we always knew that we liked old tables, old floors, old everything, you know, old neighborhoods. So we got this location, and we had found it, and that was all right. It was cheap. In fact, we opened Joe Beef for $60,000. And we were looking in history for a very relevant, very, very relevant name for a restaurant. And we came upon the story of Joe Beef. There was one article at the time on the internet about it. Now there's way more, but we found that on the McCord Museum website, I think. It was talking about this guy who had, like, 200 years ago, this old sergeant from the British Army that fought in the, or the old cantonier from the British Army that fought in the Crimean War, that was able to kind of disappear that night and came back with beef to feed his troops the next day. But his name was Charles McKiernan, but he got his nickname Joe Beef from there. Came to Montreal, got his walking paper, left the army, opened his tavern, and the other boat workers and the dock workers in the old port would just... adopted the place. You know. He was very, very helpful. He would, like, go all over the streets at night, find the drunks in Snowdrift, bring him back, stoke the fire with coal. He also figured out that it was cheaper to buy coal than to wash sheets, so everybody slept without sheets, but with a hot stove. And he would take care of people like that. Of course, it was, like, probably the greatest party in there, because there was, like, a menagerie of animals in the basement that we'd pull out when... guess when people were drunk, they could fight the bear, or, like, he'd show the cougar. So there's tons of interesting stuff that was involved in quite a few philanthropy or union causes. Before there was even a union for the Lachine Canal, and the Lachine Canal was built here before that in order to avoid the Lachine Rapids. The Lachine Canal worker went on strike, and he provided them with soup, bread, everything for them and their families, so they could, like, lead a successful strike campaign. It's truly an interesting character.
So you decided not only would you name your restaurant after him, but you would grow up to be just like him too, I guess.
Yes. I don't get involved in unions too much. But the rest of it, I mean, you have to understand we tried to do a little bit of philanthropy, but the situation here in Montreal must be everywhere like that. It's like you feel like you have to get involved a little bit in every cause. You can't get involved a lot in one cause. So that's one thing that personally I think that we should be having $20,000 go to one place instead of like the 200 places, right? And then maybe pursue that legacy a little bit more. But I mean, that being a concern, we're obviously going to work towards that. But, and you know, a name like that, like Joe Beef, had we not taken that name, maybe next week or next year and 3 years ago, there would have been a restaurant or a store that specializes in beef jerky that would be right next to the store that specializes in flavored popcorn in every airport in North America called Joe Beef. You know what I mean?
So you saved it.
Well,
you rescued it.
It's crucial in a way to take names like that and to just
them.
Let them perdure, you know, and let them live on. Not leave them in a museum in a photo album, but maybe give them a second life. And they serve my purpose. They serve our purpose in this, in our business, and we serve the purpose to preserve it a little bit more, you know. And now that it's in a book, it's actually in the Library of Congress. So the story of Joe Beef is in the Library of Congress, which is not historically, and I'm talking the original Joe Beef, that's very relevant. That's very important.
Now, I wanted to ask you a question a little bit differently. Naming the restaurant Joe Beef itself had an effect on you, but were you half this crazy before you opened the restaurant?
You know what, I'll be honest with you, I think it was the perfect match. I don't think that it changed us and we changed it. It was like, you know, in retrospect, you see, I wouldn't see it otherwise, you know?
Uh-huh.
A little bit like, I look at my kids and my wife and I'm like, well, there's nothing I would change, you know? This good thing they're born the way they are, the time they were. That, you know, Joe Beef's like that a little bit. And it's, now there's a few bitter food writers in Montreal that, well, there's been a lot of tiny restaurants opening in New York. It's in Brooklyn and everything. But there's a good reason for that. You didn't need to be this 20-year-in-the-trade chef and sell your soul to the devil to be like a minor partner, if even a partner, in a restaurant that would hold your name, you know, which is weird. And you'd like sold your soul to like some corporate guy with a giant watch, you know. It's not,
so you're anti that?
Not anti that. I respect that. Some restaurants are, you know, Bernardin, for example, and restaurants like that, or Balthazar in New York, or big restaurants like that, do cost a lot of money to open, but they serve a purpose and they do it very well. But I couldn't afford that, you know, and I didn't feel like trying to pitch my story to 20 bankers before someone told me yes.
But I understand that. I mean, that's the hardest part of a restaurant is organizing these investors.
And you know, the thing with that is now all of a sudden you can call your brother-in-law who's an electrician and you can ask your childhood neighbor who's a gyp rockster, plasterer, sander guy, and you can open a restaurant finally for like a fraction of what you needed before that.
Well, now this is not just a cookbook.
No.
This
no. Cooking is
a lifestyle issue, and it says someplace it is like how you look at the world, at your vision.
Yeah.
What makes you think of these things like hot oysters on the radio?
You know, I think that if cookbook fall into literature, I think literature doesn't have to be, it's not documentary, it's not an exact documentary. You can, with literature, you can enhance things. And that's the reason why you maybe buy the book and read it.
I think this is, I told you before, this book is so wonderful. All the things in it that have nothing to do with recipes or talk about food. It made me want to hop on the next plane and go to Montreal just to come and hang with you.
Yeah, and it's a fun, I guess maybe the style went in line because we had a 10-speed press, it's a great house. We got a great photographer, Jennifer May. It was her first cookbook. Since then, she's worked on 6 cookbooks since then.
Oh, really? It's good. The photography's excellent.
And I did most of the food styling with her. And you know, we had a good graphic designer at 10-Speed, a good agent in New York.
It's so edgy and wonderful.
It was perfect, right? Everything fell in line well. It could have been worse. It could have been, somebody could have had a completely wrong vision at 10-Speed and we'd have to fight with them on the phone and blah, 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 and it wouldn't work. Now,
how has it been? You said you had a lot of fun at your launch party. And
yeah.
How are people receiving this book?
Well, listen, yesterday it was funny because you know what? I'll tell you, it's exactly like Joe Beef. And my partner David likes to use that example of a dining room on a given night, a nice Jewish family from private surgeon clinic, you know, a nice other family from like Lebanon in the toy business, 4 motorcycle criminal gang, but that just took out their kids for for once, you know, like, and yesterday, I have to say that it was like that. We had, like, a lot of friends and a lot of people showed up, and it was very civil, and everybody was really happy, and everybody, you know, we had, like, about 15 other restaurants or, like, musicians and people like that that just so said, like, yeah, I'm in, like, let's go, let's do it, and they helped us. It was a beautiful party. A lot of people showed up. Yeah, you turn around, it was like, oh, well, this is, I turn around, and Alan Richman's walking in the party, you know?
How funny. Was he in his grouchy state or not?
I don't know, to be honest. I didn't know if I had to. I didn't. I'm one to maybe believe that I should form an opinion by myself. And I said, this is a nice party, and mostly my parents are there, so we're not going to breach that and open the conversation. You know, it's.
He never did anything much for New Orleans, did he?
Maybe my friends at M. Wells, too. You know, there was a whole GQ article.
Oh, your friends at M. Wells, too.
But you don't know, even if, like I said, this is not the Tribune to solve an issue like that.
No.
You're a food writer. You're not a wrong email reply writer. You know what I mean?
Now, tell me this. How did you figure out what you needed to include in this? Like, why did you select a huge section on railroads?
Okay. We always love trains, okay? And when I my first student loan to go to college, I bought a train ticket to go overnight to Halifax with it, for example. So I was broke for the year after. I always loved it. And I was thinking about that the other day. I was kind of promised myself that one day travel by train often.
What's romantic? I mean, it's so filled with nostalgia.
Well, when you're a kid, you want to buy the tools to build that biggest tree house.
Yeah.
But then, I don't know, at the same time as, like, girlfriends, when girlfriends come, you forget about Playhouse. But then there's the beauty and the innocence of, like, useless project. And I think train is not an incoherent chapter, maybe, to have in a book, in a cookbook. But why not? It's my passion. So we tried it. We just sat down and we're like, okay, what is Joe B for? Well, it's Fred that loves trains. It's this, it's that. And that was a chapter.
And the same with you felt obliged to teach people to build a smoker.
Yeah, and that's another thing. But does the world need another book on food according to seasons?
Thank you. I guess
the books need another food with pictures of smiling pigs in the hands of, like, handsome farmers. No, it's not. It's been done, and I think it should go two ways. It should go into the absurd, or it should go in the very academic. A new repertoire, a new LaRousse, or into the books like our good friend Martin Picard, this album, and he's coming out with another book on Sugar Shack. Books that you read, you go back, you move up front, you go an insight into the culture of the restaurant you're in at that time.
Well, now the actual food parts, you don't really bow to any kind of potential crossing of the line. You say you put it right up front what you want to do. I mean, a recipe for horse meat in here.
You have one
with Velveeta.
But there's some with foie gras and Madeira and truffles at the same time. Like I said, it's more of an anti-statement. If you open the book in the first or second page in the jacket, there's the picture of the blackboard, okay? That's the blackboard one day, and I put a joke. I was being cynical about people that write large amount of description before their thing, you know?
Yeah.
I got this beautiful quartz ham, but the one that they make with chestnut or whatever, with acorns.
Uh-huh. Yes, okay. Yeah.
And then I wrote on the blackboard, I wrote small batch, local, handcrafted, artisanal, heirloom ham. But I wrote everything, and out of all the days and all the pictures that they chose, it was that one. Fun. So that's going to go two ways. Somebody's going to think I'm a ding-dong, or somebody's going to think that this is super cool.
But we actually are forming the impression that you're a bit of a ding-dong.
Yeah, that's good. You got it right. But you see, a lot of what's funny with chefs, and a lot of them are most of them are my friend. I try, like, most of the one I meet, we become friends, but is that there's maybe, like, I wouldn't say self-hating, but we want to be more than people that cook great food. So we get involved into this farming, and we also, all of a sudden, we become like economists and political activists and everything. There's a huge problem in North America now, and in most of the world, industrialized world maybe, is that the kids eat bad food in school and the kids eat bad food at home. But I'm sorry, it's not mesclun salad that's going to fix that, right? We're past now. My legs are cut. They won't regrow. You know what I mean? Okay, so that being a serious problem, I think that's not a cool chef in downtown Manhattan that showed kids to make squash ravioli. That's not going to work because he's preaching to the converts, right? It doesn't need to. I think that Target or Loblaws, these here in Canada, or Walmart, or all these big companies make a small change, that will have a bigger impact overall. And the same goes for Velveeta, for example. If they see that Velveeta is maybe respected, and there's a need for a cheese like that, but not made exactly like that, maybe they'll take a step back in time and change something for something more honorable in the cheese. And that will have on the world a bigger impact than if I show a kid how to eat the maggoty cheese of Corsica.
Now, listeners, just in case you're thinking that these people are quite mad and they have this funny little restaurant called Joe Beef that maybe I ought to think about going to, you have a little bit of an empire that you put together. It's not just one establishment now that you own.
Yeah. We had three restaurants. We had a sandwich place was located right next to Joe Beef. And then two doors down, we have Liverpool House, which is the same restaurant with different kitchens and different colors and different art on the wall. But it's basically the same thing, except that Joe Beef has all this garden and the smoker and everything. So it's a little bit of the center, but Liverpool House is just as good. And McKiernan was a sandwich place. But you know what? I'll tell you, we get, of course, now you see it all the time with all the review online and everything, and of course there's people that there's always haters out there, and there was so much letters coming in, people taking time writing a letter because the waitress told them that we don't serve croissant, you know, and they go somewhere else, you know, and crazy things like that. And you'd have like letters of hate from a guy that didn't like the sandwich, the $9 sandwich, you know. We're not talking about a $50 a person rib steak there. And plus, it wasn't fair to the customers, maybe, because we can't be there. I couldn't be there. Allison wasn't there. David wasn't there. No, we all have kids. We can't go there. And it wasn't fun thinking that you'd walk into work and then there's already, like, somebody that screwed up, like, half the restaurant that morning, you know?
I don't know how we can convey more than we have already. Listeners, if this sounds like something you're interested in, buy the book.
If it sounds
like something you're interested in, go to the restaurants.
I'll add something to that.
Go ahead.
You know, when people go to a restaurant, it happens that maybe the early reservations were late and the later one were earlier, so all the food has to come up at the same time. And, you know, snafu sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Things doesn't happen always, you know, and beef comes from an animal called a beef, and that being an animal, it's not always the same. Sometimes it's stressed, and the meat could be tough, or sometimes there was your supplier's 2 weeks, they added a 2 week gap in the aging, and it's not the steak you thought you were going to have. But when people come to the restaurant, we try our really best to make everybody happy, and that happens that sometimes, like I said, the steak's not good, or the service was slower, or whatever can happen. But it's important to remember to give the restaurant a chance to change things in the course of the night before. In fact, then there's a way to mention to your server, to the chef, or the owner, doesn't matter, that you were looking forward so much, you hopped on a train, you came, you flew, you swam, you came to Joe Beef, and this is not the food, the steak that you expected to have. But, and if that's the case, we're going to give you the steak that I would serve to my, you know,
uh-huh,
to my kid for his graduation dinner.
Yeah.
I'm going to do all that's in my power to make sure that your meal turns into the best experience of your life. And I find it's especially with all the online reviewers and the blogs and everything, it's important that we people come in with an open mind. And if you don't like your seat, you can mention to have another seat, or if your drink is too strong, I'd ask for more ice. But an evening is not a linear one. Our destiny, your destiny is in our hand for the course of that evening. But we need, like, pointers at certain time, you know.
That's very good thought.
Yeah, and sometimes...
It seems like such common sense. I don't know why we don't...
It is common sense, but you know, sometimes you show up to a table and there's a steak, it's mangled on a plate, and people say, like, that was shit. I'm sorry, but you know, is that the way to send back a steak or to comment on something? If the person would say, like, oh, that was not this, I thought it was, like, the big one that I had last time. Well, listen, we're going to make a double-sized one. We're going to put wild mushroom, and you're going to have potatoes with black truffle and Velveeta. With your steak. You know what I mean? But it's all in the tone, you know? And oddly enough, I can't make a parallel. I can't say, like, young, old, this, that, professional, layman, or whatever. No, it's everybody. There's as much impolite people in all classes of life. Doesn't change. And sometimes the waiter, it's hard to get their attention, you know? Sometimes it's okay to pour your own wine in a French bistro, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes if they have time, they'll pour your wine. And it's like that. It's life. And if you don't complain, but show interest, it's even better. If you walk in and you're like, wow, I've been dreaming about these oysters that I had from Colville Bay. I'm going to have 12 oisters. Oh, you guys have, like, Dungeness crab. I had them in San Francisco. They're my favorite. I think I'll be too full. It's okay. And then a rib steak. And then you just, like, you just made a friend in the kitchen or at the bar. Somebody's, like, saw you. He knows you're, like, happy to be there and excited. So we're going to multiply by 2 the amount of food that you ordered. And put little things in between and, you know, it's always like that. It's always, oh, we read your book and I'm so sad that you don't have the beer cheese. And be like, well, we have like a batch that we're making for tomorrow. Have one, bring it to your hotel. Here are the crackers. And that's how we are, but given the opportunity to be, you know.
I think we're going to have to come and see you for a week.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And you've solved my problem. Once we planted Jerusalem artichokes and they become a weed and I can't pull them up enough. And so I always have them and I've never been able to figure out what to do with them. And you have a perfect recipe. You kill them in coarse pretzel salt and dunk in the
mayonnaise. Oh, the Jerusalem artichokes, the sunchokes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. But you see, I did a little interview we did for another website and I'm sad that she didn't read the whole extent about that rant on pretzel salt. But pretzel salt, most of us grew up with that, and it's, in my opinion, it's just as honorable as Malden salt, you know, which is factory made anyway somehow. And pretzel salt is the perfect texture to offer a crunch and some salt. It's not coarse salt. It's not just and it's interesting to bring it back in food and not go with, like, this is Himalayan salt or this or that. And,
well,
and like Jeffrey Steingarten made me realize, salt is salt, right?
Well.
there's only shapes of it.
If you want a little joy in your life, get a hold of The Art of Living According to Joe Beef. And what we're going to do to get a little joy in our life is plan a trek to visit you, Fred.
Absolutely. And I think it's a short train trip or Montreal, New York. They have old trains and it's old tracks and everything. But if you make it up in Canada, try to maybe take one of the trains with a dining car there to make your trip around here. It's fun.
Unless they're going to be cooking our menu.
You know what? We're working on that. Maybe we're going to make, like, I know I hate pop-up restaurants, but somebody told me yesterday, your pop-up should be
on the train.
Dining car.
Right.
Yeah, dining car for a week.
That's not a bad idea, you know.
Let us know if you're going to do that and we'll come and get
my
ticket.
I will. And that would be fun.
Yeah, as long, where are you going? Where was it I went to Canada that I hated?
Edmonton.
Edmonton. As long as we're not going to Edmonton.
Oh, that's where I'm going tomorrow.
I know.
Week,
I know you said that, but I feel like it's on the edge of the earth.
What brought you there?
It was some kind of a big city festival.
That's too long a story.
Anyhow, well, it's been...
But it's getting much better there, actually.
Is it? I mean, I was so depressed because of all the empty skyscrapers, you know, just are heartless, soulless.
Oh, no, it's much better now.
Oh, okay.
Did you go there a long time ago? Or?
Yeah, a long time ago.
No, the oil and everything, and they, it's gorgeous. Well, no, not gorgeous, but there's, and again, you know, the same thing is hitting maybe these cities. That's the same thing in all America, the small restaurants. There's a guy that comes back to his hometown, and he maybe worked in New York or Toronto or Montreal, and he has $100,000 in his pocket, the money he gathers with his family, and he opens a little place with maybe Ukrainian heritage cuisine.
Yeah.
And that's popping everywhere. So it's actually good, the small restaurant thing. You know?
Oh, I like it. Yeah.
Well, listen, we're going to let you cure your cough and your hangover.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to use my least favorite medication, which is going back to work, but that's all right.
Thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu, Fred.
Thank you so much to you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And if you think the interview sounded crazy, you should have tried it before the sound editor got his hands on it. But it's really a fascinating story. It sounds like so much fun. We just can't wait to go there. But in the meantime, we need to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Thank you for staying with us. We're moving on to two more cookbooks that are sort of compilations, but with a certain amount of attitude. Listen to our discussion with the authors of Made in America and Off the Menu.
And Made in America is all about America's top chefs doing comfort food. And the other one, second one, what's it called again, sweetheart?
It's off the menu.
Menu
is family meals at great American restaurants,
which is another way, I guess, of restaurants showing how much they care for their employees just as much as they care for their diners. A really fascinating story.
When I called our next guest, I said, "Lucy, this is Jack Spratt calling." And those of you who know any English nursery rhymes will know that I'm talking about Mrs. Spratt who ate no lean.
Jack Spratt could eat no fat. His wife
could eat no lean. But Lucy Lean eats both.
I do.
And Lucy Lean has just produced, I am having so much fun with your cookbook, Lucy. It's called Made in America, our best chefs reinvent comfort food, and it's a joy. First of all, you must have had a ball doing this, because all of our favorite chef people are in it.
I had the best time. It was one of the best projects, and just to be able to travel around and meet all of these amazing chefs.
Because that's the reason I enjoy doing this show, is you get to talk to everybody.
Yeah, no, I think that really, somebody asked me yesterday what was the best part about putting the book together, and I really have to say it was getting to meet all these amazing people.
And they are, and I don't know how you did it. First of all, where did the concept come from?
I was the editor of Edible Los Angeles, the local food magazine.
Right.
And through my work with Edible, I connected with a lot of the local chefs, and I was given a book called How We Cook in Los Angeles from 1894, and I wanted to try and make those recipes accessible for today. And I thought, well, the hostesses of our time, compared with the hostesses of 1894, are probably our great restaurant chefs around town. So I was giving them recipes from How We Cook in Los Angeles. And then the publisher said, love the idea, love the concept, but we want to do all across America. LA is far too regional.
So you did 100 chefs.
I did 100
recipes.
Yeah.
And how did you pick them?
I put together my wish list of people, and I worked my way through the list, contacting them, and I have to say there were very few, I think there were a couple of people who said no because of scheduling conflict, and then one person pulled out halfway through. But apart from that, everybody said yes, and everybody was incredibly generous and welcoming.
And the concept was that you offered them, you know, did you say you can do this or you can do that, or did you say there's 100 recipes, which one would you like best?
A lot of the time, if I knew the chef and knew his or her cooking, I would think, oh, I really would love a recipe like this from that person. Sometimes I would sit down with the chef and they would love the concept and run with it and say, but I have to do this. And sometimes it was just a question of saying, what would you like to do? I still need a recipe for this, this, and this.
So what was the last one? Who got the last pick?
Oh, I can't remember.
I can't remember.
It doesn't really work like that. It like sort of was trickling in at different times. I can't even remember who my last interview was, which is kind of bizarre. But I think actually the last recipe that I worked on with the chef was with Nancy Silverton in Los Angeles. She developed a recipe for English muffins for me from the 1894 recipe. And I went down to visit her at Mozza, and we were tasting the muffins and testing the muffins. So I think that's the last recipe that I worked on with the chef.
Now, I guess it's a little late into the interview, but I should point out, if people hadn't already guessed, that you are English-born, and your description is you were the daughter of a farmer, right?
Correct.
And you grew up in the UK, and then you fell in love with the son of a French chef, a very famous French chef, who had a restaurant, Le Cote Basque, in New York, and that's how you got here.
But exactly. I met my husband in a nightclub in Cannes in the south of France, and he was actually on holiday there with his father, and I was summoned to have dinner with his father. And I rang my father and my stepmother in England, and I was like, oh, we have to ring Annabelle, our friend in New York, and find out about this restaurant. I hadn't really heard about it. And Annabelle's response was, I don't have anything nice enough to wear to that restaurant.
Yes, it was an old-style New York French restaurant, indeed. You have such a wealth of contacts and recipes and information here. How did you organize the whole book?
I wrote down all of the recipes that I wanted to cover in terms of classic American recipes, and then in terms of comfort food. And that was quite hard to define, because I feel like it's such a broad subject, and comfort food to one person means
exactly
something to somebody else. But I basically ordered it in terms of, well, then we broke it down into the chapters that we have now, the breakfast, the sandwiches, soup, salads, through to dessert. But it was more a question of what to include and what not to include, which was tough, I have to say.
Right. Now, the introduction is by Joe Bastianich, and he loved it, didn't he? He loved the whole concept and everything.
Yeah, Joe is a very good friend of mine, and he has kind of seen this book from start to finish.
Really?
Was incredibly helpful in terms of getting to various chefs. He opened his address book for me as well, so that was really lovely. And then he agreed to write the introduction, which I was thrilled about because he had been so much a part of the book.
And there were a number of very surprising things, like Daniel Hum. How do you pronounce his last name, Hum?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
And I thought it was pronounced differently, doing a hot dog. Now, I thought that was pretty cool.
I know. And what was lovely about that was that he was so thrilled that I was so shocked when he said he wanted to do the hot dog. I mean, of course, I was thrilled that he wanted to do it, but the hum dog, as it's known, and it's absolutely perfect in terms of elevating it with, obviously, truffles, and it has some sort of celery cool thing on it. It's absolutely delicious. And then it has the Gruyere cheese, which gives a nod to his Swiss heritage.
And that's, I mean, the homemade bun. Just...
Well, no, actually, he doesn't use a homemade bun. He uses a regular hot dog bun.
Oh, I thought he used it. I thought I saw a recipe
bun. No, it's a regular potato. It's a regular potato.
Yeah, you know, he doesn't make the bun, which is interesting also in terms of the history of the hot dog and how the hot dogs originally were just put between two pieces of bread, and it wasn't until kind of the early 20th century when mass production of hot dog buns, and it became a standard thing, and it was standardized. So that was interesting.
And what were some of the other surprises of these recipes?
Okay, I think Wiley Dufresne was a wonderful surprise. He was very reticent about the concept of amazing chefs cooking comfort food.
And oh, yeah.
We sat down and talked for a long time about the project, really, which was great for me.
He's very, very intellectual. I don't want to say intellectual, because he's also extremely funny.
Oh, he is incredibly intellectual. It was a really cerebral conversation.
Yeah, but he also loves eggs.
Yeah, and he loves eggs. So he said he has a personal connection to eggs, and he wanted to do eggs. I think what's surprising about his recipe and from where he's coming from in terms of his food is scrambled eggs is something anybody can cook. It's probably like a 101 where to start with cooking. But not only does he give the best recipe for scrambled eggs, and they are so creamy and delicious, but he also suggests adding cream cheese into it because it doesn't break down and it makes it even more delicious. And then he gave me the recipe for smoked salmon thread, which is tapping into his more, can I say, molecular cuisine end of the spectrum of cooking.
Right.
But it's not difficult to do, and a home cook can actually make these salmon threads. And you can make them the night before as well. If you have a brunch party and you want to sprinkle them on top, you can make them the night before and just keep them in a jar. And they keep, I think, up to a week. So that was a really nice recipe to get, and then to be able to do it. Came out beautifully.
The other one that I really loved was Mark Vetri's Reuben.
Oh, I love that recipe. That's become a family favorite recipe, I have to say.
Oh, I loved it, yeah.
And he made it from the bialys for the recipe. He makes those from scratch. And so that recipe is a joy to have, even if you're not making a Reuben sandwich, to be able to make a bialy now.
A bialy, sure.
His recipe is a great recipe. And then just to have all of those components and then set them up as a sort of sandwich bar, and people can choose which pieces they want to put into the sandwich. If you want to make it vegetarian, you can leave out the meat, obviously. And the mortadella was his nod to his Italian heritage.
You know, I think he's probably one of the best Italian chefs in the whole country.
Oh, definitely. Well, I
Absolutely.
Thought the thing with the quote from Joe Bastianich saying that he cooks the best pasta in the country.
Oh, I think so, yeah.
And I think that's probably true. And such a nice chap as well.
We haven't eaten at Vetri's place, but we did eat at Osteria, and I guess the chef from Osteria is in there too.
He is. Jeff is in there as well. Jeff gave me a really wonderful recipe for sandwich bread and then also for the eggs benedict. So I got two sandwiches from two Philly chefs, which was really nice. And also I just want to say that Mark is the inspiration for us to do the Alex's Lemonade charitable component. We have two books that are traveling around the country at the moment being signed by all the chefs.
Oh, right.
And then we're going to auction off those books.
Oh, so you're involved with the Alex's Lemonade Stand project too?
Exactly, exactly. And that's through Mark.
Well, yes, he does the event, doesn't he?
Right. And they're doing an event out here in Los Angeles, November 6th, I think it is, Sunday, November 6th. And a lot of the chefs in Made in America coming from around America to join Mark.
Oh, that would be a big party, huh?
Yeah, it'll be great. With Suzanne Goen from LA is hosting it.
Really? Maybe we can get invited.
There you go.
we'll be on our way back from Sicily. We'll just keep on going.
There you go. Don't stop.
When is it again?
November 6th.
And it's the 6th of November.
Oh, yeah, we can.
Yeah, we get back on the 5th. All we have to do is stay on the plane.
There you go. So you'll be in Sicily when I'm going to Hawaii for a Made in America weekend at the Four Seasons Resort with five of the chefs in the book. We're doing a food weekend there.
Oh, great. Can you send me a special note about that and also the party on the 6th? And I'll put them both up on the news page on our website.
Right, because the chef Ludo Lefebvre is coming to the Made in America weekend.
Oh, Ludo, God, isn't he hysterical?
Well, oh, I love Ludo.
Is he in here?
A good friend. Yes, he's in here. He gave me a recipe for duck fat fried chicken.
Oh, wow. And yeah, that's his thing, fried chicken.
Fried chicken is his thing, and I've known Ludo for a while, but when I gave him the recipe from 1894 for fried chicken, he was like, what, is this some sort of English joke? Because we have this French-English banter that goes back and forth, because it's literally the ingredients and then a line of instructions for fried young chicken. And so he was like, this isn't a recipe. And I was like, well, that's the recipe when the old recipes are really short, Ludo. So then his recipe for the fried chicken came back, and if you take a look at both of them, you see that nothing's really changed in
I'm just looking at it right now.
He's used duck fat instead of the lard, but there's still flour, chicken, salt, spices. He's added a whole bunch of Asian spices as well to make it taste even more delicious. But the basic concept of fried chicken hasn't changed in over 100 years.
Wow. Well, you learned a lot, too. How are you going to go back on the farm, as they said? Are you back at Edible Los Angeles? Or?
No, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm now working as I'm one of the food judges for MasterChef for the Gordon Ramsay TV show.
Oh, who are you? I have to watch that then.
And I travel around America looking for contestants. So I'm part of the whole casting where we go from one city to the next and home cooks bring us a dish that they have prepared and for their interview, and I have to taste their dishes to make sure that they can cook.
Wow. I mean,
I taste a lot of food around.
Yeah,
America.
I know. Yeah, I've done that too.
You must have a large Alka-Seltzer bill.
Not just Alka-Seltzer, I need to go to the gym a little bit more often. Lucy's not so lean at the moment, after all.
Well, Lucy, please get me the information about those two events so that I can publicize them. And
totally will.
And thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu.
Thank you so much.
On The Menu is happy to welcome back for her second visit, Marissa Gugiana, and for a quite different book. Marissa, welcome. First book was Primal Cuts, and it was about butchering, right?
Right, yep.
And now we have Off The Menu, which is funny to put on the menu, I guess. And you did staff meals from America's top restaurants, and boy, you must have had fun.
Oh, I absolutely had a great time. I traveled to 50 restaurants all around the country, and I ate in the kitchens during the off hours of the restaurant and sat with the staff, and it was just extraordinary. Restaurant people, as I was saying, are just, they're a singular crowd. They have great energy, and they almost always have a really fantastic, sarcastic sense of humor.
Did they make you work too, Marissa? Did you have to work a shift?
I didn't have to sing for my supper, but it was sort of a frenzied moment because staff meal, it's not a long, drawn-out affair. It's usually 15 minutes to an hour, but there's other things happening. There's linens being ironed. There's specials getting transmitted to the staff. All these things are happening.
Complaints registered, yeah.
Yeah, and you're eating. And then I'm also trying to talk to as many people as I can, share the meal, and also I took all the photographs. So.
Oh, I said, Peter, these photographs look really candid. I wonder who did the photographs. So you did.
I did all the photographs for both
groups. Great.
Because I'm traveling for such a long time, it didn't make sense to bring a photographer. So I just said, I'll take it on. I'm not a photographer yet, but I'll give it a whirl. And it's really fun, and it's just another way to enter the experience and get to know people.
Oh, I thought they were very good photos. Nice. And intimate. There was a certain intimacy about them I liked. Now, how did you select these 50 top restaurants? That's kind of tough.
It is, and it was really hard for both books, and I could have made 5 books on the same subject. There's so many great places, but staff meal can be very perfunctory, and some staff meals are unhealthy food with no love in it. That's just kind of like, all right, we got to feed these people. Here's some tater tots. So first off, they just had to be places that really valued the staff meal and really wanted to make something good for their employees.
But how did you determine that?
Well, first, I always try and find restaurants that are farm to table. And I picked cities first, and then...
Oh, I was going to ask you that, because you want a geographical distribution.
Yeah, I wanted to capture what's going on in different parts of the country, and then...
Well, you didn't talk about Pittsburgh. We had, except it's closed now, we had a restaurant that got a national award for a family meal.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it's closed.
Oh, well. They spent too much money on family meals, but it closed.
Maybe. Drove them under. Yeah, so then... They were interested in being part of it, and they're a really special restaurant. They had to have some kind of cachet in the restaurant world. And then you start collecting stories, and then you want to just keep finding different kinds of stories special about this place. So as it goes on, it gets easier and easier to kind of pick people out because you get a mass, and then you start finding the ones that stand out from that.
Yeah, well, it must have been tough, though, in major markets like New York.
Oh, my God. There's just so many places in New York. It's just...
So who did you pick? I'm trying to remember here.
I have Franny's in Brooklyn, which is one of my favorite places.
Right.
And also Le Comptoir, which is a great little French bistro in Brooklyn. And then in Manhattan, there's Corton and Miranda.
Yeah, how'd you get him to agree to do this?
He was totally open to it.
He's really difficult with media.
Yeah, I've heard that. He was really great. He's serious, and his staff is serious. Like, I had to beg them to come and sit down with me and eat staff meal and chat for a few minutes because they eat standing up at their station. And
I can picture it, too.
All of his kitchen is immaculate and beautiful, and all of the food has 8,000 steps before it gets to the table. And so it's a really busy kitchen, and there's a large staff, and it's really head down, as they say. But, really welcoming, and he made a gorgeous meal, and it was something that he's made since he was a boy.
He's so talented, my goodness.
Oh, my God. Yeah. He made a shepherd's pie and a cauliflower gratin and cookies and brownies and a Caesar salad, and
uh-huh.
It was beautiful and perfect. It's one of the more complicated recipes in the book, of course. You know?
Well, he's a very complicated, but I hear that he's sort of softened around the edges since he found love. He has a girlfriend. Did he marry her?
Oh, I didn't know all that backstory, but I think
he's
also...
Oh, you come here for all the gossip.
I can see that. I think he's also happy at Corton. I think he... had creative differences. He's one of those genius, hot-headed genius types, which I do talk about in the book. But he's happy there. He gets to express himself. I think he's happy with the staff and the food he gets to make. And
Drew gives him a big, wide berth to do what he wants.
Exactly. Exactly. You got to do that for the team.
Now, you had Maria in New York, I think, and Locanda Verde as well.
Yep. Really special experiences at all of them. Maria was, they also have a huge staff.
I love Maria.
It's such a cool space, and the food is so excellent. And the chef there gave the creative control on the staff meal over to these three really young women who are from Korea, and they made an amazing Korean feast.
Oh, wow.
It was so excellent. They made a ton of dishes, and the staff of, 50 or 60 people, it must have been. I filled up a large section of the dining room, sat together and ate, and it was awesome.
Now, for each of these, you have the restaurant, you do a profile of the restaurant,
mm-hmm.
you do the menu for staff meal, and then the recipes, mm-hmm. and then some chefs you actually do a Q&A with.
Yeah, for all the chefs in the book, there's a Q&A that I devised. I call it the Escoffier questionnaire, sort of a play on the Proust questionnaire, where they're short questions. Some of them are a little silly, but all of them kind of tell you something about how they cook. And the difference in the answers gives you a sense of how much of an art cooking is. I mean, how much of a personal expression it is.
I don't think they're silly questions at all, because they're questions very similar to the ones we ask when we interview a chef. And in fact, it's almost like you were copying my list, because sometimes chefs will ask us in advance what the questions in the interview are going to be, especially those who are overseas and perhaps aren't terribly facile in English. So they all want to know the questions in advance, and they look very similar to your Escoffier questionnaire. I wonder why.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's the things you want to know.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, tell me this, after this whole project, did you come away with any kind of ideas about what staff meals are, how they differ? What conclusions did you reach?
Well, I noticed that, and I think there's, I mean, part of the reason to even make this book is because everything I would say about staff meal, I think there's a real parallel to cooking at home. I noticed that the places that really cared and really wanted to nourish their staff and would take a moment to sit together and make something that was good had happier staff. They just, the people that worked there felt more a part of the restaurant. They had their heads held higher. They stayed, less turnover. And it's not all about staff meal. It's a short moment in a shift, but it just reflected something that was really nice, the respect that people have for one another.
There's a message there, isn't there, probably, mm-hmm. that says, if you're going to cook for your family at home, approach it in the same way if you want a happy family.
Exactly. I know not everyone is going to be a foodie or is going to delight in spending a lot of time cooking dinner, but almost all of these recipes are really fast and made from inexpensive ingredients, because they have to be, because staff meal needs to happen quickly and cheaply. So it's not about spending hours on a gourmet meal. It's just about, like, making something with love and then taking the time to sit down together and enjoy cooking the meal together, enjoy eating it together, and then cleaning up together. It adds a lot.
Seems like a great idea. We're a little worried. The generations who are younger than we are, it seems like they don't have mealtimes anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And has a good friend who has a young daughter, and that's all. And she doesn't make meals.
Mm-hmm.
She has food available, but she doesn't make meals.
Mm-hmm.
And our son and daughter-in-law and their two children, our wonderful grandchildren, are the same way.
Mm-hmm.
The only time, the mealtime, I think, is when we visit, and that's usually because we cook it.
Holy days, yeah.
Otherwise, it couldn't be one. And there's something fundamentally wrong with that, because people who are happy with food, chefs who are happy about food and who are successful in the business, all have this common thread that they grew up around meals at the kitchen table, which were prepared with love and sometimes with a great deal of skill as well. And that's what got them started down this road of this career that's either wonderful or not so wonderful, depending on how you feel about it. And so it worries me just a little bit, I think.
Yeah, and it's a point well taken. And I think, you know, in a restaurant or at home, it's just an excuse to spend some time together. And my family, we always sat down to dinner every single night, even though we all had our activities and everything. And it's like, sometimes people are grumpy or the food is not that great, or you're eating leftovers or whatever, but you do it every night. And it has this cumulative value that takes you through your life. It's really important.
Well, we do that here. And, we're delighted to have your book called off the menu, because it's a good way for people to say, well, I can't simulate the fine dining experience at Restaurant Danielle or at Marais or Bernardin or Thomas Keller's establishments or any of these things, but I can cook something very similar to what these fine restaurants prepare in a very simple way, because I have the recipe.
And they are good recipes. That's a good thing to know about the book. It's not only beautifully presented, but it's beautiful.
So, Marissa, thank you once again for joining us on the menu. Two books in less than a year. You were back in May. You're here now in October. How soon are you going to be back again?
I'm going to take a little bit of time off from the book frenzy, but there will be a second edition of Primal Cuts, my first book, coming out next fall. We're going to do some updates on all the butchers and see where they're at a couple years later.
Oh, interesting.
Well, we look forward to talking to you again. You must let us know when it's ready to roll.
Excellent. I will. Thank you so much.
Oh, Marissa, congratulations on two wonderful books.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And if you're ever interested in setting off for a wild adventure, listen to this discussion with our next guest. However, I would advise you that probably it would do you well, if you're doing this, or what they did, to be young and carefree.
And where in the world with Matt Lauer is on right now, but he's got nothing on these young people's adventures.
Well, Peter thinks you both are mad, but you'll have to ask him why he thinks that. I think but he meant adventurous. We're talking to Mary Kate and Nate Tate, who are a brother and sister team that you had vast experiences and adventures in China, and it produced a book called Feeding the Dragon, a culinary travelogue through China with recipes.
Now, here's a question. When you started out with this adventure, did you really think it was going to be a book?
I think we did on some level, but we originally was a blog.
It started out with Nate went over to China to study in Beijing at a university for a year, and I'm younger, and I was in high school, and I went to visit him for the summer. So we traveled around all over the country and just found it such a fascinating, amazing country. We just found so many foods that we'd never had before. So that was when we started thinking, you know, it would be awesome to come back and make this a book to take back to our friends. Then years later, I went back and had my own study abroad experience in Nanjing, and then we both came back the next year to travel. Put this book together.
We thought it'd be a lot easier than it was.
Yeah, you said a year's project you were thinking of, and it ended up being.
To be really honest, I thought we were going to be about 6 months.
6 months.
Yeah. And
it ended up being 6 years.
Yeah. So it was. Yeah, it was a lot more difficult than I thought.
It's called the impetuosity of youth.
Yeah.
Well, then it's fascinating. You traveled really frugally.
Yeah.
And you went way off the beaten path. How did you handle the language? I know you both studied Mandarin, didn't you?
Yes, we both did, yeah.
But what about all the dialects and everything?
Well, in China, the government in mainland China, they dictate that all media, all schools have to speak Mandarin.
Okay. So that helps, yeah.
You know, there's certain areas like Tibet and Xinjiang province that are allowed to have their own languages, but pretty much you can get by with Mandarin. So we were all right.
So people can understand you. You might have to stretch a little bit to understand them, maybe?
Yeah. Like in Tibet, there was a lot of miming and hand signals and things.
Sounds like me in Italy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I said before we even went on air that this book is so dense with information. How to give the listeners some sort of sense of tone of it and what you went through and what they might find in this book? How about some of the, what happened that you didn't expect? And give us some idea of some really unexpected adventures or some adventures that you think people would really want to know about.
Okay, sure. That was kind of the exciting part of the book was, it's really our adventures as we travel around, and there weren't a lot of planned things that we did. We had been to a lot of the places before, but we definitely found ourselves situations.
A big part of it was figuring out, you know, our idea was to go around and collect recipes from restaurants that we really liked and people, you know, just going to their homes and learning how to.
I just thought you were just so incredibly naive and thinking you could just walk into everybody's kitchen.
So sometimes that got us into trouble. I remember one time we went into a Xinjiang restaurant.
Yeah, a Xinjiang restaurant, and that's the area, that's the province on the upper left-hand corner of China. It's a Muslim, the people there are Muslim, and breads and kebabs and things like that, and noodles too. So we went into this restaurant, we wanted to learn how to make these hand-torn noodles. And we got there, we'd arranged with the chef to teach us. We got there early the next morning. We show up, and he gives us these white chef coats. And he thinks that we're going to be line cooks for the day.
There were about 50 other line cooks there.
Yeah.
And he took us, they actually live in the building, above, kind of dorms above the restaurant.
Uh-huh.
Is sometimes how it is in China.
Yeah.
So they put us in a room and said, change into your chef whites and come down. So we actually worked in the kitchen the entire day.
And we didn't know what we were doing at all. There were a lot of flying pieces of noodle dough, and you know, a lot of them were ending on the floor.
So you didn't even know how to cook when you went?
Well, no, I've always liked cooking, and my parents, they both cook a lot. Our parents cook a lot. But yeah, Chinese food, I had a... We had an ai, which is kind of like a woman that comes in and cooks for you in your house. You can get that in China. and I would learn from her, and that's what kind of got me into Chinese cooking. But yeah, we learned a lot of this stuff straight from the people when we were traveling around.
Now, your recipes, are they authentic? Are they going to be reproducible?
Yes, yeah. You know, one thing, we tested all of them many times in New York and also in China and tried to make them where if there was like a very difficult ingredient to find, we tried to find an equivalent for it. But we tried to make them easy for home cooks in the States to cook. But yes, they are very authentic.
So if you were trying to find shark's fin or bird's nest?
Yeah. Well, we give some websites in the back of the book where you can order that. We don't cook with either one of those in the book.
No, I was just thinking of those as an example of something that's not exactly on your grocery store shelves.
Dried sea cucumbers, you know, there's a lot.
Tell us about your yak experience. Yak,
sure,
yak, yak, yak.
Are you referring to the story where, Mary Kate?
Right.
Yeah, we were in Tibet, and she's always the more adventurous one. And situations like this, I'm the more cautious. I think I'm the older brother, and she got up next to the yak. We saw this yak. She wanted to get her picture taken with it. And I, you know, they have these huge horns. They're like a cow, but, you know, on steroids. And she didn't want me to take the picture, and I was... And then, but the picture didn't work out, and she wanted to get up again next to it, and yeah.
I did that with a kangaroo, actually, in Australia with Peter, and the kangaroo kicked him in a very unfortunate part. You know, they just suddenly... stand up and kick out their back feet.
I'm glad the yak didn't do that.
Yeah. No.
There was another time when a monkey was like jumping on her also, and I was terrified, and she wanted me to take a picture of it.
Yeah, I think the monkeys are a problem, aren't they?
In Sichuan province, they're in the mountains.
No. Are they the ones that climb up the trees to pick the tea leaves?
I don't know.
No, somebody was trying to tell me how fabulous this tea was, and he said that it was grown very high up in the mountains, and it was picked by monkeys.
Because it was very high up the tree.
And I believe that, and I have a bridge to sell you.
Yeah.
Now, did you come to, I'm looking here, for example, I'm dying to go to Macau. Did you love Macau?
Yeah, I love Macau. We both loved it. The food is great. It is becoming, you know, we've gone to it, when did we first go, 2005?
2004,
and then we went back this last year. And it's amazing to see how much it's changed because there's been so much money from Las Vegas coming in. It really is like the gambling capital of the world, I think, now.
Oh,
and
I
it
see.
Has a huge Venetian casino, and there's
the
Wynn.
Terrible.
So there's a lot of, that's become a huge part of it, but there is still the old Macau still
there.
Yeah,
that's the mishmash of cuisines is what I was interested in.
Yeah, it's really great. There, you know, there's still, the street signs are in Portuguese and Chinese, and you see a lot of the people look like they have Portuguese ancestry, and then the food also has, it's just this amazing mix of Portuguese and Chinese fusion food.
Oh,
like,
nice.
For example, fried rice, they put olives and chorizo in it.
That's fun.
Yeah.
That's really great.
It's great.
Now, I'm going to ask you, did you end up favoring any particular province or style of cuisine? That's a hard question, I know.
I would say, I think my favorite is probably Yunnan province in the south. It's a large province next to, it borders Burma, and they have a lot of minorities there that speak their own languages and have their own unique foods, but there's a lot of jungle down there, and there's a lot of fruit in the foods, like fruit, you know, there's papaya and beef stew and things like that, which I think are really fresh. And there's salads, which you don't really find elsewhere in China.
Oh, really?
I know Mary-Kate, she loves Sichuan.
Yeah, I was going to say I always favored Sichuan myself, but I don't know all the other places. So, but
I absolutely love Sichuan hot pot. It's so much fun to eat with your friends and cook it at the table, and it's so spicy. It'll just take you over. Just so hot physically with the steam coming off the pot and in your mouth.
You know, they give you all these little plates of meats and vegetables and this big cauldron of boiling spicy broth in the middle of the table. And you just take your chopsticks, dump the raw ingredients in the pot, let them cook for a few seconds, and then you dunk it in a sauce like sesame paste to let it cool off a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great. It's really fun, and, you know, it's a really fun thing to eat, too.
So it's sort of like the Japanese shabu-shabu.
Exactly, yeah.
Or, I mean, it's like Mongolian hot pot. We should know something about
that.
Yeah. Our nephew married a Mongolian princess.
Oh, wow.
And they had the wedding in Cornwall in England, because he's English. But they were going to, he showed pictures, and he has his own yurt when he visits and stuff.
That is so cool.
It is cool. I mean, he's really provincially raised and very, very English.
Yeah, not
so
the,
I love it.
Not the slightest bit adventurous. I mean, he's never even been to visit his uncle and aunt, but he went off to Mongolia.
But they were supposed to redo the wedding for her family because they couldn't come because of the season of the year. They were busy with their herds or something. They were going to redo it in Mongolia, but I haven't gotten an invitation yet, but I'd be right on the plane.
We actually went up to Mongolia a little bit because we had in China it's kind of difficult to get a visa to be there for a while.
Uh-huh.
So for a while we had to leave every 30 days this last year.
Yes.
And the cheapest way was to take a bus up to the border of Mongolia, and we'd cross the border and then come back.
Well, you mentioned that in your book?
I don't know if we mentioned that.
We did mention
taking a trip to Inner Mongolia.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it then.
Taking yurts for a weekend.
Yeah.
The yurts
are very luxurious, except for the picture of the toilet on the beach was pretty funny. It was a regular toilet, you know, and it was sitting on the beach. Oh, well. I thought it was a bit odd. That and the stew with a kid's head in it, that was cheap. That was a bit strange.
Not the child. Not a child.
No, not the
child.
Yeah.
A small goat.
No, it was took
me a second
sheep,
to realize.
I don't know. Tell me this. What was your biggest surprise?
Our biggest surprise?
In putting the book together?
No, in China.
I would say how easy it is to travel and how friendly the people are.
Okay, that's good.
It's amazing how hospitable the people were. We would be totally lost and not anywhere near a hotel, and someone would offer to let us stay in their home.
Yeah, it'd be 1 o'clock in the morning, and we'd show up to a bus stop, and someone would offer to help us find a place, a hotel, and like drive us there. I don't think there's any other.
Let us stay with them, or want us to stay with them, and cook with us, and they're not expecting money.
Yeah, I don't think there's any other country. We were thinking about, where else could we do a project like this?
Uh-huh.
If we would do something else. And I just don't know if there's any other country that's as large and that is as safe, and it would be the same as China like this.
So, but it has to have been pretty safe for you to have been able to cover this territory. And
yeah, exactly. I never felt threatened ever.
Yeah, neither did I. And we were looking for danger.
Crazy, yeah, crazy.
And what about your biggest culinary surprise?
I would say Sichuan peppercorns.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever cooked with those before?
Yes.
We've had them once in a while. When I was a student there, I'd have them sometimes. But I'm just amazed, the versatility that they have in cooking. You can put them in something that's sweet. We have a recipe in our book, actually, for green tea shortbread cookies.
Dusted
Sichuan peppercorns on them. But you can also put them in spicy things. They have this chemical in them that makes your mouth a little numb.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not really a spiciness. But when you add it with other chilies, it kind of brings the chilies to a new level. It's like spicy and mouth-numbing. But yeah, I just think that it's a great ingredient, and it's a flavor that you just don't find in the West, that they use it all the time.
Well, now, I think you've answered my next question.
Okay.
But you're looking for your next project, and you haven't found it yet, but you're going to put your experience to good use in a different book, right?
Yeah, we would love to do another book, or even it would be great to do some kind of program where we could come back to China and trace the steps of our book on video, whether it be, a TV show or a web series or something, because I think China is just such a visually beautiful country. To go on the adventures like that would be amazing to do.
Well, we can't wait for you to get back to us and tell us what you're doing next. Be sure to come on and tell us what you're doing next before you do
it. We will.
And then when you're done, we'll have you back on the program again. You're just the kind of adventurers that we are not.
Okay.
And like Sarah, American plumbing.
I do.
So this kind of trip is one we'll never make, but we certainly enjoyed reading about the fun you had on your adventure.
I'm glad that was the point.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, my mother loved China. She went several times, but she was afraid of what they chopped up in the food, so she took peanut butter and crackers.
Yeah. We've had people visit us with whole duffel bags full of
crackers.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Well, congratulations on you, and I hope you just take off with this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we'll talk to you with your next project.
Okay. Sounds great.
Okay.
So there you have it, listeners, on the Menu Radio for another week. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.